So I think sort of summarizing everything that's gone on in the last week, certainly in the last 3 months, is too much of a job for one man. So what I decided is that I'm going to supply the generality, and I've requested a bunch of you to contribute to the discussion, and let's see as an upshot of that how the future looks. Okay, before I guess Jocelyn left. No, she's back, good. So before I sort of get on to that, I want to place on record the appreciation that all of us, I'm sure, share for the support for the Physics of Glasses program by the KATP, by NSF, David Gross, the director of KITP, and the advisory board, which saw it appropriate to support this program. Marty Einhorn, who has been helping us all along in putting this together. Secondly, I want to support all the wonderful staff, thank all the wonderful staff at KITP, starting with Deborah, Monica, Timber, Julia Neeson, Vienna Zeitler, Kevin Barron, Craig Kunimoto, and the other IT staff. And particularly, I would like to thank Jocelyn Quick, who single-handedly put the conference together. So let's thank Jocelyn, and please carry our warm sort of thanks to all the KITP staff who do a wonderful job in making the experience here fantastic. Just to sort of say it once more, my first time in KITP, and it's a wonderful institution, and it has a fantastic concept of how to promote interactions among scientists. And so I want to thank all those who conceived it and who keep it going. And Jim, you can take the bow on behalf of all those involved in the first part of this. Okay, so coming to sort of a sum up of the program, in putting this workshop together, we had sort of broadly three communities who we wanted to sort of get to talk to each other at some intense level. So one community is the sort of people who largely focus on properties of glass-forming liquids, and by extension, glasses, but, you know, I put traditional in quotes, but, you know, molecular, polymeric, etc., oxide glasses. And a second community which sort of, again, largely interested or focused on understanding mechanical response of amorphous solids to applied stress. And a third community which is interested in making, characterizing, and understanding metallic glasses. And so we've had sort of people from all these communities present during the workshop and also during this conference. And it's a wide canvas. So here I put down some sort of key notions that have come up in discussing things during the workshop and during the conference. You know, you can read the keywords, but these are sort of largely concepts that come up in looking at glass forming liquids, the nature of the glass transition. So we've talked about configurational entropy, mode coupling theory, random first order theory, dynamic heterogeneity, strings, length scales, kinetic facilitation, nonlinear Langevin equations theory, activated hopping, free volume, polyamorphism, strongly correlating liquids, cooperativity, fragility, boson peak, rigidity, constraints, soft modes, jamming, rheology, soft glassy rheology, aging, etc. And here is another sort of cluster of keywords, non-equilibrium thermodynamics, effective temperatures, STZ, shear banding, failure, plasticity, avalanches, effect of temperature, and the shear rate. glass forming ability, nucleation, packing, elastic heterogeneity, toughness, brittleness, and so on. And you know, I sort of started to make this list, sort of thinking that I'm just going to have a huge number of words that will just sort of illustrate how diverse people's interests and focuses are. But actually, it's not so scattered. So to group it in some along some themes, okay, here are sort of some of the thing, you know, some sort of categorized ideas in along themes. And I think these are sort of both what have been driving forces in our interactions during the workshop and the conference. Areas for the future are, so let me say a few words before I open this up for discussion. I think one sort of, in general, in looking at glassy systems, I think one very important theme, which remains to be completely rounded out, at least to say the least, is a description of non-equilibrium systems. And this has been a rather prominent topic of discussion here, and in the context of SDC theory, you know, soft glassy rheology. I mean, these are all actually areas which relate to this particular theme. And I think a key concept here is this notion of effective temperatures. It came up yesterday, most recently in discussions like Michael and Jim Stock and so on. And there are, of course, a lot of interesting ideas and insight, but one question to raise is whether we see a convergence on sort of understanding this notion of effective temperature, which is very fruitful in a variety of contexts, but do we understand how to sort of think of them in more or less the same way in the different contexts where it comes up, and whether we have a convergence on sort of this kind of an effective temperature description in these different contexts. I mentioned two cases. One is when you have an aging glass, and the other is when you have a sheared or solid. Okay, so that's sort of one broad theme. And again, in looking at the nature of structural relaxation, there's been some focus on sort of looking at the nature of elementary processes that lead to structural relaxation. And there have been sort of a number of different angles on this question. One theme has been looking at the at sort of length scales and the meaning of these length scales. The other has been, so in this context also, you can put this discussion of strings and heterogeneity and so on. The other has been sort of trying to look at the relationship and the respective roles of diffusive versus activated dynamics. And something that has been touched upon, but to my understanding, not really fleshed out yet, is an understanding of the similarities and differences about how to think about these elementary processes in supercooled liquids versus in sort of amorphous solids under external stress. And I think it'll be very interesting to look further along those directions. And a particular issue in this context is how these sort of elementary steps in structural relaxation might interact with each other. It seems to me that in the context of stressed solids, there's sort of a far greater, at least concreteness, to how these processes talk to each other in the form of sort of elastic stresses and avalanches and so on. But there is some discussion of this in the context of supercooled liquids in the form of notions of facilitation, but I think it's not anywhere nearly as concrete at the moment. And so it would be interesting to sort of take that further. In particular, I think the role of elastic stresses in liquids is sort of underappreciated or understudied, at least, and that would be a direction in which to look further. Okay, so I won't say too much about this, but this is an abiding theme, the nature of the transition to arrested states, the glass transition, but also, looking at jamming, there is sort of the question of how these two relate. And as Jean-Philippe very nicely summarized, there has been a lot of work in trying to understand this better. But I guess there is no definitive agreement on what the nature of the glass transition is. I'm sure more work will continue to be done. A theme that I personally would have liked to see discussed a lot more, though some amount of discussion did take place, is sort of looking at structure and structural change as sort of a key focus, its role in dictating slow relaxation, glass forming ability, nucleation, structure of glasses. Like I said, all of these have been touched upon, but I think there's no common perspective on how to think about this. And it would be interesting if that emerges over time, sooner than later. And so during the chalk talk I gave at the beginning of the workshop, I quoted Anderson, who sort of said that the glass problem of the glass transition is one of the most important problems in condensed matter physics. And so the quote ends with, whether it will help us make better glass is questionable, an understanding of the glass transition. And I said that, in fact, one of the things that we would like to explore during this workshop is whether, in fact, theories of glassy relaxation and the glass transition will help us make better glasses. And I'm not very sure what the answer to that is. Maybe some of the people from the community who's engaged with making these glasses can answer that question for us. So one particular item I'll mention here that has come up but needs to be sort of discussed further is what role the ability to sort of make models, computational models of these glass formers, which are transferable, which can be studied routinely, what role that might play in sort of quickly sort of transferring understanding and know-how between sort of the basic studies on looking at glass formers and sort of making metallic glasses. Okay, so that's sort of my summary. And before I sort of hand the mic over, I would like to put this up. I hope that even if it's not already happened, or in addition to whatever may already have happened, I hope that the interactions that we've had here will sort of prompt us to think in new and creative ways and come up with new ideas and research. And if it does happen, which I very much hope, it would be nice to have the outcome of these published in one place together. So with this in mind, we have a topical issue on glasses that is being put together with EPJE, and here is a call for papers end of March next year. So there's enough time for you to go back home and start thinking about and writing those papers. I hope many will contribute. Okay, so let me, with that, and you will be, well, you have got this in the email as well, but I just thought I'd put it up in case some emails bounced. A lot of emails bounced, actually. Okay, so let me go back to this, and let me start by asking people, starting with Jim, to...
Well, I raised some raise the subject, but I was hoping that Franz would talk.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to have to leave. And my problem is that I'm not away from home.
Right. But do you want to say...
Well, let me see what Franz...
Okay.
Okay. Well, over lunch, Jim and I and a bunch of others had a discussion, a general discussion of what the current picture is of the deformation of the glasses. And the really view from 30,000 feet, if you want, is that when we get to look at the problem, you can approach it from two sides. You can go at it as metallurgists, which is the way I came to the problem, really, and the way other people come from the fluid side. So if you take a fluid and you make it more and more dense, you go to the glass transition. But what is it that changes there? Likewise, you can start with something that is very well organized, and you can, you know, the crystal, of course, was the original idea where you introduce defects. You can do something similar. You can have a structure in which you start introducing certain sites, defects, flow defects, whatever you want to call them. And the question is, how do you splice these two together? What is the way you can bring these two approaches together and have a continuous picture that will take you from one to the other? And we're a ways away from that, but the more we look at it, the more we're beginning to understand how both sides do that. And certainly in the way I've been working on this is coming from this, from the solid side, and Jim has been doing similar things. And so what we've been doing is trying to identify what these sites are. I think we've done remarkably well speculating about them over the years, given the phenomenological information that we've had. But now we have ways through simulations and through looking at colloids and so on to actually see these things happening. And so we actually now know what these sites are, that we should start identifying more and more of those and exactly how they, which ones will respond to stresses and which ones will give us the deformation as we see it. So the questions remain is how much of the detail of all of this can be obtained with a specific description of what these zones are. And so, for example, if you take the plus and minus defects as introduced by Michael and Jim, in that case, there are certain features that are immediately can be approached directly that are not so obvious from the others. For example, if you look at the plastic recovery, if you take the form of metal plastically and then you take off the stress and you let it sit, well, we know there is a little bit of recovery if it happens that the crystal is due to dislocation, run back and things like this. Well, what's the equivalent here? Well, clearly the internal stresses must play a role in that, and there are certainly ways that one could take other defects and look at, for example, how the built-in stresses work on this and how they will take them back. So I think there are many ways, for example, the idea of the steady-state flow stress. That it's pretty much a consensus that this is a balance between the creation and the annihilation of these sorts of defects. And the question is, what are the specific mechanisms by which they do that? And you can look at that phenomenologically and make certain conclusions, but certainly our hope would be to look at the real thing by looking at computer models and colloidal models and see if we can indeed find these things that we think are operating to either create or annihilate those. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of progress in the next 5 years or so, too, but while we continue to look more and more at these processes.
So,
I'll say just a couple words before I turn into a pumpkin. that's an American allusion. France is exactly right.
Is the mic on?
One.
Yeah.
France is it on? Yeah. Is exactly right that. We're trying to approach this as opposed to the mode coupling people. We think that the right way to approach many of the solid amorphous plasticity problems is to start with a solid and see how it starts behaving a bit more like a liquid. And that's been the whole idea of understanding how there are flow defects that appear somehow. And the questions now are, well, how do you do it? And what I realized, actually most clearly, because Franz gave a wonderful talk just yesterday, and I've been, you know, look, I've been following what Franz has done for decades, and so I've sort of understood it, but he put the whole thing together in a way that, just because Michael and I had put it forward in our version, and I could see exactly where there are serious technical differences. And in fact, just as Franz said, probably the crucial technical difference is that our version of the STZ theory says that there has to be an internal degree of freedom that is associated with the orientational memory of the state. And that when you put that in, all of a sudden, a number of features come out. The most sort of visible is the strain recovery or Bauschinger effects or something like that. But probably the deepest part of this is that it immediately gives you a definition of the, we call it the dynamic yield stress. It's not the peak stress, it's the minimum flow stress. That is a dynamic transition between a state, or an exchange of stability, really, between a state in which things are jammed to a state in which things are not jammed. And the jamming immediately comes out by saying, okay, these STZs, especially in the non-flowing states, have this orientational thing. They're all lined up in the direction where they've been pushed by the stress. And if nothing else is happening there, you can't go any further. That's the jam state of the system. Whereas if you start annihilating and creating them at a sufficient rate, which is again going to be determined by the stress, you have this transition to a flowing state. When you add to that picture the ideas that I'm enormously fond of, because they did things that I've been very surprised at, that you can make a sort of a generalized thermodynamic description of these things with this effective temperature and with the first and second laws of thermodynamics and stuff like that, so that you can compute in ways that you'd know the generation of noise in the system, which is going to drive these transitions. You immediately identify it as the rate of entropy production and proportional to that. Then I think the picture is coming together in a very nice way. But now we have to get back to Franz's way of describing it and see, okay, is there a difference? I'm predicting, I'm putting my foot out or something, if Franz follows through with his kind of theories, he will not get the transient effects right. You turn the shear rate on. You see first you see the thing behaving elastically, then you have this sort of competition between elastic and plastic phenomena, and then it relaxes in some way. Most interestingly, it goes down, and there's a time scale that comes out, which is not going to, which I think comes, I know comes out of our stuff all right, because I've done it for metallic glasses and for and chain, and comparing it with a variety of numerical simulations, starting with Mike's. So I'm pretty sure, but I suspect that could be the smoking gun. But we need to find out, and I'm hoping Franz and I will work together to find out.
Yeah, that certainly will. And I think some of this is related in some ways to the aging problem, that is to move defects in and out.
What
other mechanisms for that? And our approach is going to be to try and find as many of those in the real thing, like the colloids.
And we want to broaden the applications. I think I'm at the moment very curious to see how we apply it to soft glassy rheology, toothpaste and stuff like that. And there's a whole lot of it, very, very interesting things to do.
I really have to go. Thanks.
My wife. Thank everybody very much. Exciting programs that I've seen. I've watched a lot of them. Of course, they'll be around for another some weeks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Franz was talking about coming from the solid side and coming from the liquid side. It seems to me that where the liquid and the glassy solid meet is an interesting line that draws across these categories, because in one sense you're talking about a thermal glass transition, but you could also be thinking of the onset of plasticity as being a mechanically induced glass to liquid transition. And that leads me to a sort of question which might be of mundane practical interest, and that is, thinking in terms of, I apologize, Poisson ratio and its correlation with the system being brittle or plastic, and its possible correlation with the liquid being strong or fragile and glass forming ability, are we forced to a conclusion that as you make a system a better and better glass former, it is inevitably more and more brittle? Or is there any way we can break through to a different paradigm to unlink those?
So a better and better glass former in terms of the ease?
Yes, in terms of ease.
Right. Okay, so Michael's taking the question.
Well, just to quickly follow up on that, I mean, I know in the simulations we've seen that competition between preparing glasses that are strong versus preparing glasses that are resistant to shear bands.
Yeah.
And typically you have a choice of one or the other.
Yeah.
Right, and so that may be, an interesting related question. Yeah, I just wanted to take a moment since Sri asked people to comment. I just wanted to say what a few of the things that I saw this week that I thought were exciting. So I thought in particular the increasing relation of these colloidal systems to the molecular to the actual glass forming systems
glasses
is incredibly exciting. I mean, especially since, you know, I mean, I just think of them as big analog computer simulations. But you know, I think there's a lot of potential there, and particularly after Andrea's talk, actually talking about how do you map formally from a hard sphere system to a soft sphere system, which is something that's always puzzled me. It seems like we're at the verge of something really coming together and allowing us to move forward in ways that we weren't able to before. So I find that very exciting. Going back maybe to Franz and Jim's back and forth, and I'm not going to go into the details of STZ theory, don't worry. I think this is really an interesting stage for theory, because I think the constitutive models are really at the verge of starting to make some interesting predictions and being testable and being comparable, and I think that puts a certain onus on the theorists to sit down and take the time to make sure they understand, you know, what each other are saying and figure out where the points of difference are and figure out what the experiments are that need to be done, and then to convince, cajole, or coerce our experimentalists and simulating colleagues to test those things. And I think that'll also be really exciting.
Can I just add, I mean, this is in response to, it's a question in response to what Lindsay was asking. I guess sort of glass forming ability, and good material properties may be related, but maybe it's not necessary to look at it in that prism, through that prism, but rather just thinking in terms of what annealing does. So how much of an understanding is there now about the sort of shear banding and that failure mode becoming a stronger effect with annealing, I guess is one way of asking the question.
I know in simulation it seems to be, the more you anneal, the more you end up with shear bands, and that seems to be what the theory.
Right, so that's an observation now without reference to glass forming ability.
Glass forming ability is a little, I don't know, fold glass forming ability into that. Do you have that?
No, but maybe that's not what I'm suggesting is that's probably an incidental connection that with when you have something that's a better glass former, in the process of making the glass, you anneal it better because you can do so.
Or maybe you end up with a more deeply optimized structural state that's maybe more amenable to instabilities.
Right.
That may be another way of saying it.
So that may be...
And then just one last...
I don't see, but I mean...
Just one last quick comment, which is that I think there's also this other exciting thing, which is that we have a lot of statistical data now about all the things that happen in the systems and how to connect the statistical models to the constitutive models in ways that help us distinguish between constitutive models. That's also, I think, going to be an area of a lot of activity. So yeah, that's another exciting part of that.
Mark, you have the mic.
Okay, so I wanted to make a few comments. I guess I'm this may be a minority position in this audience, but I appreciated the perspective that Franz brought to the discussion in sort of contrasting the liquid state approach to these problems and the solid state approach. And my background is very much on the liquid state side. And I know I didn't do a good job of explaining sort of how the polymer glass modeling community does this modeling. And it's very much a liquid state approach. It's an effective time approach in which you say, I know what the response of my material would be if I deformed it at equilibrium. And at TG minus 20, it would be unbelievably slow. If I force it to happen, it will happen faster. I'm going to use the same response that I would have used as if it were happening in equilibrium, but at each point along the way, I'm going to adjust the rate at which time is moving by in order to make the right things happen. And so this approach leads to yield, it leads to strain softening, it explains what happens when you anneal longer, you get a bigger overshoot in the yield stress. So I'm not this is just a completely different idea for how to describe, as far as I can tell, how to describe the yield of a solid than the STZ approach or the free volume approach. And it has, if it were perfect, I wouldn't be doing experiments because this is sort of the literature that I've been reading to see how well it works. So it's certainly not perfect, but there's a lot that these models can predict. I have the sense that near TG, the phenomenology of polymer glasses and metallic glasses isn't that different, at least if you don't go too far beyond the yield point. I think there are other mechanisms that, distinct mechanisms that kick in at larger strains. So I have a sense that basically this is the same problem, Jim was talking about the difference between the STZ and the free volume approach. This effective time approach is these two approaches look the same compared to the effective time approaches. And so, I look forward to the resolution of this because I don't think they can all be right.
Okay. Would you like to? So, Mark, if it's a response, why don't you go for it? Is it a response?
Yeah, because I've got another stick to the. Okay, so I'm going to throw another stick in the fire. Do you want Takeshi to go?
I thought Takeshi was trying to say something about this.
Yeah.
So it's slightly different. So go ahead.
Slightly different. Okay, go ahead.
Mine's really different, though.
Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, we need a contribution from the right wing. So far, it's.
Bride of the groom, bride of the.
I may not look like Sarah Palin, but anyway.
So far, all the.
Let me throw out three things. The first is that the purpose of this conference was to bring several distinct community together, and I think everybody agrees that it went well, right? Don't you think so? That this discussion happened, and a lot of. Deep and modern superficial understanding, deeper discussion really is taking place, and finding similarities between these or among these sort of apparently distinct groups. So we should continue this by all means. Number two is that one of my students said that things we'd never heard in this conference, such as S of Q. Okay. Yeah. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, we spent so much time about this. When you say structure, that means geovaroness of Q and etc. What that means, that's what it means, is that the macroscopic experiment is now a little bit behind. You see, when we say structure, because it means MD, because we can see it, right? If we can see where the atoms are, why do you have to worry about experiment and see the real thing? But there's a trap, of course, you know, that the MD is not the reality yet. And, you know, ultimately we have to make connection with the real experiment, and then at the next level, maybe several years later, that you know, I'd like to see more of this crosstalk between experiment-based and model-based. And third point is that the point that Franz brought, and there have been discussion going on, the liquid view and solid view. And to me, that means solid view is like a sort of view of a history of empires. You know, that the countries dictated by a few kings and queens, the story about a few kings and queens and bad guys, you know, bandits and stuff like that. The king, the leaders of bandits wrote the history, right? And that's the solid view, where that the solid, most of them are inactive, and few defects makes a story. Now,
so okay. You want a Leicester democracy?
Liquid is the perfect. Yeah. Liquid is a perfect democracy where everybody participates, and therefore there's no distinction. If you time average, everybody acts in the same way, right? And glass is in between. And the people from approach from solid side try to think of a few bad guys or a few kings in the solid, and try to blame everybody. And from liquid size, that people assume that everybody has a chance, such as mode coupling. You know, everybody couples and they get into the game. And I think that obviously the truth is in between. And the fluctuation is the key. Fluctuation gives us every opportunity. You know, American dream is that everyone can become a millionaire. Of course, you have a chance if you wait a million years, and you know, if you try a million times. So, how to deal with this highly fluctuating system? You know, that the, you know, fluctuation is what's necessary in the solid view, and the correlation of the fluctuation is what's necessary in the liquid view, right? All these fluctuations are in high temperature liquid, it's dissipated, it doesn't do anything. There's no communication. So I think more useful view is that there's a high density of active defects. Many of them are not participating, and some of them together by three or four coming together can do something. So I think that's the direction that I'd like to see. Argument going.
Okay, so it's not a million years isn't up yet, but I suppose it's my turn now. So I do have another stick to throw in the fire. Some very, very nice comments, lots of really neat discussion, and I've learned an awful lot on things that I had no idea about before I came here. And so we've heard from Franz and Jim about STCs and deformation. I see structure on Sri's list up here quite a few times. Temperature as a scale, jamming, and so on. One of the things that we talked about in the conference, but not as much as I would have liked to seen, is the influence of chemistry. And Walter gave a nice talk. Mike Whittam gave some very nice comments. I think of glasses from a rather narrow range. I think of the metallic glasses. Of course, we have the colloid glasses, where chemistry, if you want to think of it like that, really doesn't exist. You have repulsive potential. We think of, like the last speaker, oxide glasses, where you have very strong, very directional bonding. And I think of interactions. Okay, good. You're in there, Sri. In the game.
I hang out with chemists.
Yeah, okay. So I think there's an important influence of the relative magnitudes of the chemical interactions, and I think there are probably some key insights that we're missing at this point by looking more carefully at that. And there are different approaches, and again, there are people I'm familiar with Mike Whittem's work and Don Nicholson and others, where and Ma, by the way, who've done some really, really nice studies on very selected systems. But I think there's also insights to be gained by looking more broadly across wide ranges of systems and looking for trends that are difficult to pull out when you look at a very detailed analysis of one or two systems. So I think that there's an opportunity there, and I think that while what Takeshi said about the current state of molecular dynamics I think is correct, nevertheless I think they can provide useful insights, and hopefully that's an approach, an idea that might foster from this meeting and maybe go forward in the next few years as well.
Okay. So just to sort of, if there is going to be any response to this, just to make it a little bit of a sharper question, I mean, what would be interesting is to ask and try to answer whether chemistry can give us a simplifying principle rather than sort of being another complication.
Another degree of freedom.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you and throw in complication rather than simplicity. Maybe I'll just offer some sort of general and philosophical thoughts about interaction models that we've been using. So we've learned a great deal of fascinating statistical properties and universal properties based primarily on simplified models such as Leonard Jones or soft spheres, and these models have the great advantage that they're very quick and efficient to simulate, and you can work with large systems and long timescales. So they're certainly very appropriate for that purpose, but what they lack is any compelling connection with the systems that can be studied experimentally. And so I think in this conference we saw, in fact, two very distinct areas where there is room for precise comparison of model and experiment. And one of the very beautiful recent developments in the field has been the colloidal systems, where you can actually image with microscopy the individual trajectories of each particle. And these are claimed to be almost perfect perfectly reproducing hard sphere systems. And so you would, of course, have thought this would be a perfect place for comparison of theory and experiment. And it seemed to work pretty well. There was only 120 orders of magnitude discrepancy between theory and experiment in that area. The other area that's closer to my own heart involves the chemistry and what can be learned using first principles simulations. And there, again, you have the possibility of a very intimate matching of theory and experiment. And so you can simulate liquid or glassy structures that are in very fine agreement with neutron or X-ray diffraction experiments. So we really think that we get the structures and interactions right. The only problem is that we can't reach the system sizes or time scales on which some of these interesting universal properties are occurring. So those are just some thoughts about interactions.
Thank you. Okay, Conrad.
Well, maybe I'm not so much on one side of the solid or the liquid, but rather have a more broader view. I don't think you can come from one or the other side, and you necessarily have to. If you study the four-point correlation function, which actually is the difference in the different sizes of the defect, starting maybe from the unhappy atoms, going up to the two-level system, very low temperature, see then also the vibrations, the jumps, the strings. We had a very long discussion in the beginning of this workshop about the strings and the plastic events later on, and then the homogeneous flow maybe. And if you can study that either in the MD simulation or in the colloidal system, but also indirectly maybe by some studies of what kind of cooperative behaviors is dominating these different regions of time and in space, that actually is the key for me to see both sides at the same point. And at some way we had in the program, in the workshop, actually discussions where they meet, whether you have it's worth the temperature or whether it's stress. the elastic plastic transition is just a matter of where you look for, and obviously that's happening coming from both sides. So I don't see that there are two worlds coming together. It's actually one world, and for me the four-point correlation function is the key to study. One disappointment I would like to make, and I said it already one other day over in the small seminar room, is can simulations or insights from colloidal systems help to make a better metallic glass? I happen to know one of the leading groups very well, and I can tell you it will not help. Today, Wang showed you very shortly only that microalloying makes a lot of difference. If you're adding 1% or if you're adding half a percent, a tenth of a percent of another component into the soup, then the alloy which you produce is very different. The so-called glass formability, whatever it is, whatever it means, is changing by orders of magnitude if you're adding something to it. And so I don't think that if you can, well, maybe I'm underestimating the MD people, but I don't think if you can add 1% of a different system into that, you can predict something on that. But for that, much more interesting is to study crystallization, because that is would be the key for that. And I saw some, Thomas showed us some papers where he started to do that, and also the colloidal system, that might be a key to help out to make so-called better glasses.
Okay, I mean, a quick reply to this is, I thought we agreed the other day that we're not going to use computers to do the 10,000 samples. And but there are other things to do which might help. So yeah, understanding. I mean, okay, anyway, let Walter say more.
So first of all, I was very impressed by this workshop, of the quality of the presentation and of the science going on. And I imagine the last 3 months that you have been here, and it was really very exciting. Things that I was a little bit astonished, in quotes, to see this week is that there was a lot of discussion about very simple systems, but basically one has to face reality. There is something else than hard spheres and tetrahedra. And many glass formers, oxide glass formers, have structures beyond first, second nearest neighbor. And I think for some of the properties, it's really important to have this intermediate range structure. And therefore, it's nice to see that, for example, Dan Miracle this morning pointed out, well, there is something beyond this very short distance that one has to care about. It might be interesting for packing, etc. This is in context of metallic glass forms. So I think it's nice to look at glasses at intermediate length scales. And then also there is attraction. I mean, also, it's not colloidal systems are nice, hard sphere systems for metallic glasses, but much less has been studied in the past for attractive colloidal systems. But these exist, and I think it would be nice to make a similar connection between the hard sphere colloidal systems and the metallic glass formers. And I think this will come, and I think it's also will be very interesting to see what are the similarities. Then I was there was very little on fracture. I mean, on damage. I mean, there were several nice talks about what's happening in metallic glasses, what's going on if you shear them or put them too much under compression or tension. But many glasses they break not because you are putting in tremendous stresses, but small stresses, and then much later something happens. And this is not that clear what are the mechanisms. And also there from the colloidal glass community, very little is being done. And I think also there it would be nice to see a bit more. And then regarding theory, of course there are the various models that are written up there. What I'm still missing a little bit is on how let's say, MCT or Alford or the approach of Ken Schweitzer, they actually come together. Because at the end, I believe, I do not want to say there will be one theory. This is asking for too much. But I do not even see that there is the same type of pictures. Sometimes we are using the same words for not the same things. Well, and this, something has to be sorted out. And is it really the same thing or is it not the same thing? And so a little bit more work in this direction has to be done. Okay.
Okay, well, I think what Mark Ettinger and Takeshi said was something that's been on my mind. I mean, I've been talking to Jim Langer on and off for the last couple of years, and he represents someone from sort of the non-liquid side. And you can't get beyond a very early part of the discussion before you realize the way one thinks is totally different. So, for example, if one wants to understand plasticity very far below TG, the first thing that comes up is that there's a density of defects. Now these defects are not equilibrium defects, presumably. So these defects are somehow loosely defined as evolving either in response to shear or as in Franz Spoppen and Dave Waitz's toloid experiments. You see these rearrangements being thermally activated in colloidal glasses under almost arbitrarily low stresses. And so how do we, from a theoretical point of view, go from the liquid side of things, where we don't normally talk about these defects, to make contact with the other way of thinking about it? Or do we need to do that? Or is it an issue, if you're well below TG, that you need to think about things differently? This is not uncommon in physics, as opposed to above TG. So when I work on aging and polymer glasses and my interactions with Mark Ettinger, it's like he said, there's these effective time ideas. We don't necessarily bring in effective temperature ideas. And the order parameters are things like the amplitude of density fluctuations. This is a measurable quantity, but as Takeshi says, it's a distributed quantity over the whole system. We just don't, line one is different. So I'm not sure I'm coming to any conclusion here, and I'm not sure we need to look for some universal way to think about things well below TG and well above TG. But earlier in the program, we had these discussions about, and this is up on Sri's very nice summary, strings, democratic clusters, facilitated defects, STZs, et cetera, et cetera. Now, do these things represent, you know, what are these things? I mean, are these the cooperatively rearranging regions, and then we have to think about how they're interacting? The way we think about interactions apparently at low temperature is through elastic mediation, which ultimately can become avalanches. The way we think about that in the liquid is completely unclear to me. The one approach that sort of does this in an empirical way is the facilitated models. And I thought David Chandler's recent work, where he's tried to identify what these defects are and assign a concentration to them, was interesting. These are not equilibrium defects. You have to run the trajectories and you have to coarse grain in space and time. So I thought this is a small step, or an interesting first step from a microscopic point of view, to try to define what a defect might be in the liquid state. I don't know whether that's the correct zeroth order starting point or not. But in the liquid state, I mean, you know, as Alexei discussed, I mean, what do we mean by cooperativity and what do we mean by heterogeneity? Is cooperativity some elementary thing and heterogeneity is the coupling between them, or are they fundamentally inseparable? And it's not just mode coupling that's a very averaged, homogeneous thing. Even the standard Adams-Gibbs. I mean, I don't really know how that's related in a simple way to the STZ picture, where a density of defects comes in. Okay, so this is a bit rambling, but these are sort of things going through my mind, and actually it's very helpful to just think about these things. And as a theorist, will we ever get to the point where we can in some sense see how these extended defects come out of what Walter described on Monday as a Hamiltonian theory? And to me, as a material scientist, which is primarily what I am, I don't like losing all the non-universal stuff. I'm interested in the chemistry and all the rest of it. And so how can we keep the virtue of these local theories, such as mode coupling theory, what I've done, what others done, but then get to the larger scale? I think this is a grand challenge. I don't know if it's a doable one.
Thank you, Alexei. Okay, I'll...
So what I want to add also that I'm not sure really whether coming from just liquid side or from solid side can help us. My feeling is that's where they meet, that's where really the most interesting part. And one of the point which I have seen from all these talks, we talk more and more about this medium range order. And in my view, this is a very crucial point because essentially it creates very strong fluctuation because the sizes are so small, it's about 100 particles, let's say. So fluctuations are very big because just thermodynamically system is very small. And that, in my view, might create particular physics which are not liquid-like, where everything moves more or less separately. And it's not solid-like. And that one of our problems is how to really take into account these fluctuations which are far above what you will take in perturbation theory. And that's maybe one of the complexions which we have.
All right. So after this, I'll invite somebody who wants to have the last word.
One point I just wanted to make is that as far as I can tell from both simulations and from the experiments on colloids, we have a lot of evidence for flow events, but we do not have that much evidence for flow defects. So at the moment I would still be, I mean, we have been looking a lot for that and it's not so clear that you can see defects in any way. And another point maybe as a response to Mark on polymers, I'm not so sure there is such a big difference from a structural, I mean, from the point of view of mathematical structure in the kind of equations people are using in polymers and in the kind of STZ equations. Or, I mean, these are all kind of rate and state equations that people use in friction as well. And it's not so surprising that even though the concepts behind them may seem very different, they eventually lead to the same kind of mathematical behavior.
I think logically Michael should have the last word if he wants to. Since
I heard Sri has a bunch of bottles of wine in his office. And
no, it's been
a real pleasure organizing the program, and Takeshi was really the lead on the conference and getting the conference together and having everybody here and everybody being so willing to engage in discussion, often on talks that were on things that were maybe only tangentially related to what you happen to be doing at the moment. So I'd just like to thank everybody for coming all the way here and for participating so actively. And I hope we have more of these. So, great. Thanks.
Okay, if you want to close the session. Okay.